in dealing with open source and patent issues. We have panelists from industry, panelists from legal practice, and panelists from academia, so I think it should be a really well-rounded discussion. I want to thank Paul Ohm, Wendy Seltzer, and Anna Noskizi for putting together such a great group and such a great conference generally. So in the interest of time, let me just briefly introduce our panelists just by saying their names and where they're from, but there are more detailed biographies in the program if you're interested in finding more about them. So let me start out first with Julie DiCecco, who is legal director in the litigation department of Oracle Americas. Next, we have Jason Schultz, who is a professor of law at University of California, Berkeley, and also director of their Samuelson Law, Technology, and Policy Clinic. Next to him, we have Jennifer Urban, who is also a professor of law at Berkeley and also co-director of the Technology and Public Policy Clinic. Next, we have David St. John Larkin, who's an attorney with Merchant and Gould. And last but not least, we have Lucky Vidmar, who's an attorney at the law firm Greenberg Traurig. So let's start out by providing a little bit of context for the audience. I don't know how familiar people are with open source and patent litigation issues. But for those of you who aren't familiar with some of these issues or have just joined us, let's start out by talking about what are some of the concerns dealing with open source and patent litigation. What are the typical litigation scenarios that we're seeing? Are patent and open source litigation scenarios frequent? Are they infrequent? And in particular, what are the scenarios that we're looking at? Are we seeing developers of open source projects, things like software developers, the Mozilla Foundation, or the developers of the Linux operating system? Are we seeing them being sued or being threatened with suit for patent infringement for developing their open source projects? Are we seeing non-developers, just companies out there in the business ecosystem who happen to use open source tools in running their business, are we seeing them being sued or threatened with suit for patent infringement or both? So Lucky, let me toss it out to you if you can talk a little bit about this.
Well, I think as was mentioned in the first panel, the patent infringement lawsuits against accusing an open source product are extremely rare. So that's the good news. Whether that will stay the same is a question that we could all talk about. But we haven't seen any lawsuits against developers. The lawsuits that we have seen have all been against companies who are either expanding or looking to grow, or just a strategic decision gets made that this particular company would be targeted for a lawsuit. Now, I should say, I am not sure that any of these lawsuits can be viewed as an attack on an open source community per se. I mean, I think these are just patent infringement lawsuits that could have just as well been filed if the accused software was proprietary. I don't know if my friends here would disagree, but that's just the sense I get. And that I get that sense from the very first case that was filed, and that was the famous Firestar versus Red Hat case in 06. And there you had Firestar, who was a company that had a product in the object relational mapping space, and they sued JBoss, another company in the same space, over a patent that they held. The reason I don't think that this had anything to do with open source software is the timing of the lawsuit was just as JBoss was being acquired by Red Hat, right? So you kind of think to yourself, well, that's strategically interesting timing. It all had to do with making a quick buck, I think. You know, you sue a company that's being acquired, you think you're going to get a pretty quick settlement. It didn't end up working like that, unfortunately, for anybody involved. That lawsuit lasted a long time until it was finally settled in 08. In the meantime, there was a lot of things written in the blogosphere. Everybody went crazy when this lawsuit was filed, and how could they do this? But You know, I think as Einstein might have said it, that even light obeys the law of gravity. And you could paraphrase that and say, even open source obeys the patent laws. There's really nothing different about open source, if you think about it, that should make it immune from a patent infringement lawsuit. Now, that's the reality. Maybe we all may think that there should be something different, but really from the perspective of patent infringement laws, there just isn't. So, I mean, I can say more about the Red Hat case if you want to hear it. I had some involvement in drafting the re-exam that Sun Microsystems ended up filing in that case, but maybe that's for later. But my general sense is the lawsuits are rare, and I think they will stay rare for at least the foreseeable future.
Well, could you say a little bit more about the Red Hat case and how you think it was not per se an open source issue and more so of a patent litigation issue generally?
That's just my sense from sort of being on the inside a little bit. I actually don't think Firestar expected the firestorm that followed the lawsuit. I think, you know, they said, ooh, look at these guys are going to get acquired by Red Hat. There's going to be some money there. We have a patent that we can assert against them. So let's just go do it. The response, I think, as all of you probably remember, was overwhelming. I mean, there were thousands of lines and thousands of blogs written about this. And Sun Microsystems, to their credit, took the extra step of putting this patent into re-exam, requesting a re-examination of this patent, which is, anybody's allowed to do. You basically go back to the patent office and you say, look, we have this prior art and we believe that this patent is invalid. I ended up drafting that re-exam, so I feel warm and fuzzy about that. But a lot of people have said about Sun, well, you know, this is, are they being a good member of the community by doing that, or are they just being opportunistic because, hey, you know, Sun Microsystem also had a product in the same space. And I'll tell you, that's true. There was a product by Sun in that space. But my own sense, my own opinion was that really Sun took the step of protecting the community by saying this is just not, you just don't do this. You know, this is, now I'll tell you, every one of my clients who gets sued for patent infringement thinks that this is the most tasteless thing that anybody can do to them. So all open source software companies are not alone in that. But there is, I guess, something more icky if you assert a patent case, a software patent against an open source software company. Now, all the Red Hat litigation was resolved. All of it was settled. There were a few other cases brought, one against Sun and Oracle and others, and that one was resolved as well. And I was not involved in that, so I don't know what, maybe Julie knows what happened with those cases.
Well, I mean, if I could just add on to Lucky's comments. I mean, I think there's an interesting contrast between the last panel and this panel, because I think that, you know, when you really get into the depth of discussion that we just had around, you know, there's so many facets to the intersection of patent law and the open source community that are very interesting. And, you know, we heard all of those, you know, particularly some of the, you know, freedom-driven motivations that Stormy was talking about versus, you know, some of the venture considerations. And, you know, I think that this panel is very, very different, at least from my perspective. You know, the intersection of patent litigation and open source is very straightforward. I mean, it's incredibly expensive to engage in patent litigation. I mean, you know, you'll see most frequently cited figures of between 2 to 5 million average fees and costs on an average piece of patent litigation. I can tell you that, you know, it can quickly escalate, you know, well beyond that. So really you're talking about, you know, when you talk about patent litigation and open source, you really have to follow the money. I mean, you know, your exposure, whatever your role in the community is, whether you are a company that is using open source software in your internal operations, a company that is building open source software into your products and redistributing it, a developer in the community, or, you know, a company that is building proprietary software and then releasing it into the open source community, your exposure to patent litigation is directly linked to the money you're making or the money that you might be making, the lunch that you're threatening to eat of your competitor. So, you know, I think that people have to be very focused if they're analyzing their litigation risk on, you know, on where's the money and following the money. If you were to find yourself in a piece of litigation related to open source and you think that you can quickly demonstrate that, for instance, your use of that open source product is not a revenue-generating activity. Let's say it's a piece of open source software that you're using to run some internal operations that, you know, are not, for instance, linked to manufacturing your product or releasing your product. You may be able to sit down with that plaintiff and dispose of that with, you know, either no payment or a very, very nominal payment. So, you know, I think there is, you know, there's just only a few flavors, I think, of this type of litigation that we'll see. And I do think that to add on to what Lucky was saying, you know, you'll see litigation that's being driven to perhaps, you know, preclude a certain product from being released or gaining market share in the market, or you may see, I think to Lucky's point, you know, something that looks opportunistic because it's being brought in association with an acquisition. And then I think that the other flavor that you'll see is what Sun had experienced in our NetApp litigation, which is really your more classic form of cross-licensing negotiations between two companies. At the time, it was NetApp and Storage Tech, and then NetApp and Sun over, you know, their patent portfolios, which, you know, happens every day amongst large companies. You have cross-licensing discussions and threats, you know, that may go back and forth. But that entire case taking on an entirely different aspect because Sun made the decision to open source the technology that was amongst the technologies being accused by NetApp of being infringing. So that added a whole layer of complexity and you know, I think gave Sun a lot of advantage in that in the course of the early days of that litigation because Sun had open sourced something that was the subject of these cross-licensing negotiations.
So I'm sort of hearing two themes. One, Lucky brought up where he said, you know, patent infringement that happens to involve open source is not an attack on open source per se. It's just that
necessarily
open source is software, and software can infringe just like any other software, be it free and open source or proprietary. But then I'm hearing another strain, which is, well, one of the reasons many of these lawsuits have not gone after the developers is because of the deep pockets rationale, simply that many of these developers of free and open source software are nonprofit organizations that aren't generating revenues, so you can't justify the cost of patent litigation. I want to toss this over to Jennifer, maybe to talk about the Microsoft versus TomTom litigation as to whether a lot of people in the open source community actually saw that as a direct attack on open source, given Microsoft's the threat to Microsoft's business model that open source presents.
Yeah, and I think this follows really nicely from Julie's sort of analysis of what might expose you to risk if you're using open source. And you're concerned about a patent infringement lawsuit. I actually want to start, though, with the Turbo Hercules example that Stormy brought up in the last panel, which I think follows exactly from what Julie was saying. So for folks who don't know, Turbo Hercules makes mainframe emulation software, and they had gone to the European antitrust authorities to complain about IBM's activities in the mainframe market. So they make emulation software, and then they'd gone to the regulators to complain about IBM, and they got this, you know, nice patent spaced kind of letter from IBM saying, hey, just so you know, we have about 106 patents that read on your technology, just so you know. But two or three of those patents actually appeared to be patents that had been granted by IBM under its 2005 pledge of a couple of hundred patents, saying that they would never assert them against the open source community. And just like with the Red Hat situation, you know, the community really responded to this in a very negative way and was very concerned and has been kind of talking about this a lot. This is all happening this month, basically, so who knows where it's going to go. But IBM's position is they haven't backed off from their patent pledge for open source. They're not sure Turbo Hercules is really an open source company, etc. But my point is that it follows nicely from what Julia is saying as to when you might expect to have patent risk. Here you have a certain kind of company that's participated in the market with a larger player with a lot of resources and may have attracted this from a competitive standpoint or from another kind of standpoint. But the Microsoft case, I think, is also interesting and for similar reasons. So in 2007, Microsoft had said publicly that it believed that Linux violated a couple hundred, 235, I think it was, patents that Microsoft held, and the community was very concerned. Is Microsoft going to stop using patents defensively and start going after the open source community or companies that use open source patents? And that really hadn't happened. You know, they've been doing some licensing deals. But last spring, they sued TomTom, which makes those navigation systems, over a bunch of stuff. And again, within the claims, there were some claims related to file management technologies that had to do with Linux that TomTom was using in its technology. The case settled pretty quickly on what I think are some fairly interesting terms. TomTom has 2 years to conform its technology with regards to those file management processes, and there was a cross license between TomTom and Microsoft, but Microsoft got paid and TomTom didn't pay. And you could characterize this, you know, in a bunch of different ways, that the patents sort of this is just general patent litigation, right? And some of the patents that are involved with Linux were caught up in it. Or you could characterize it as, is Microsoft beginning to approach open source differently and its patent strategy and litigation strategy with open source differently? And I just think it's really important for all of us who think about this to keep in mind the difference between sort of what Lucky is saying and what Julia is saying about strategies at the company level and the perception in the open source community about what this means for open source more generally and for companies that use open source.
Does anyone else on the panel want to weigh in on that?
I was just going to make one comment. I was going to agree with Lucky. I think from my perspective, I actually strained to understand a little bit or to actually find differences in open source software patent litigation versus proprietary software patent litigation. But one of the things I think that does kind of leap out at me, and this is also coming from my days as a developer, with open source software, most open source software development is done in a very public manner. It's done where you expose your APIs. The coding is very available. It's available by default based upon all the licenses that are used. And now, you know, kind of later in life, having the hat on of an attorney, you know, prior to filing any sort of patent litigation, you typically would conduct some sort of Rule 11 analysis, some sort of analysis to compare the accused product to the patent and determine whether or not it may or may not infringe, and that forms your basis for maybe filing suit. And I think that open source software, kind of one of its, you know, kind of the thing that makes it so great may also be something that poses some risk and maybe even increasing risk in coming years. And the one place I would actually disagree is I actually would make a prediction. I mean, it's hard to kind of read tea leaves and guess what's going to happen. But I think it's one of the technology areas that's probably more exposed and more susceptible to attack from, say, patent trolls or patent holding companies, and for its very openness. You know, it's easy for somebody to examine a piece of software that is fully published and kind of vetted in a way that, you know, has comments. You can look at it and really appreciate how it works in a way that's very difficult when you look at proprietary software, or for instance, even you know, software up in the cloud. And so I think this kind of builds on what you were discussing earlier, Pam, on the prior panel. And from a litigation perspective, you know, maybe it's an easier target. Now, you still have to kind of work out the economics. And, you know, you can't really, you know, patent litigation is very expensive, and you don't really, you know, initiate a patent litigation unless there's some, you know, carrot at the end of this process. And so, you know, for those companies that provide services or have some sort of revenue stream that might attach, maybe it's not the developer directly, but maybe it's a whole host of other people who build on top of their platform. And they, you know, some, you know, potential patent holder might see that as a choke point. So I guess I would say, you know, that's certainly one area from my perspective where open source is a whole lot different than what we see in other technology areas. And I think, you know, in the future of patent litigation, you know, I would guess that it might be an easier target and easier for a patent holding company to justify the expense of, you know, filing the patent litigation and get going on that sort of, you know, well, they'll call it an investment, but... You know, there is some sort of cost-benefit analysis that the patent holder would go through before filing suit. And, you know, when you can perform the sort of analysis to maybe have higher confidence that you're going to win, then maybe this creates a better, you know, a bigger problem for open source.
Well, yeah, I mean, the examples that we're talking about, too, of course, are for-profit companies that are using open source software within their products. And if you can look at that and you can see exactly what it does and there's a good strategy there for you to file suit, then maybe that's a good strategy to take.
I wanted to add anecdotally, though, because I think it's a very interesting point. And, you know, having come from Sun Microsystems where we had open sourced, you know, a large portion of our software portfolio, I was personally shocked at how infrequently are the non-practicing entity plaintiffs or other plaintiffs had actually bothered to do an analysis of our open-sourced software before filing suit. I think, you know, with Twombly and Iqbal and, you know, increased pressure on plaintiffs in terms of their pleadings and their complaint, you know, we may see, you know, more of what you're predicting. But I think even post-Twombly, we continue to see complaints that are very vague and don't appear to have engaged in much analysis at all of the of what products may actually be later accused in the case. I do think that it can work to your advantage, too, because you can be in a position where you know, you've got an entity who's kind of a patent troll who's, you know, going through the checklist and finds themselves all of a sudden on the eve of their infringement contentions, not having done a thorough analysis. And once they get a little too far down the road, you have the high road with the judge, and you can say, "Look, judge, you know, they've had access to our stuff for years," you know, and that can definitely work to your advantage, I think. And I think to something Jennifer was saying about the TomTom suit that was very interesting is, you know, I don't think it was very clear, you know, what Microsoft was accusing them. You know, they were intentionally very vague about, you know, where in the mix those Linux, you know, the Linux-related patents were. So I do think it's just as a practice pointer, I think, you know, to the extent that very early on, even, you know, with you know, probably a very vague complaint that you have to deal with, it's really important to focus on where in your potentially accused product set or activity, you know, you may have open source. Because I do think that if you, you know, if you have open source software in the mix and you are in patent litigation, you need to use that to your advantage. And it can be very advantageous on a number of levels. So
one thing that I'll add in, too, this comes from another re-exam situation that I was involved with, is that it is also that because the development and the conversations around free and open source software tend to be very public, that the potential for prior art to invalidate or narrow the patent substantially, I think it's a lot greater because you never had those issues around was it publicly available and all this, right? I mean, the SourceForge kind of provides, and many of these other sites provide exactly the sort of prior art reference you want. It's, you know, it's indexed, it's on the web, anyone could find it since this date, which is pretty verifiable. And so, you know, certainly that's not going to work against everything, but I also think that when I've had to go and look for a defense for certain parts of open source or to advise on people, if they have that right in front of them, easy to find, or the developers can sort of say, yeah, it's all public, it's all right here, it makes your assessment of the defense a little easier too.
So the openness can cut both ways. It can act as a sword or a shield.
So in terms of economics, I'm hearing sort of two variants of why somebody using open source software would get potentially sued or threatened for patent infringement. And they all center around following the money. So the more obvious example is somebody with a revenue stream who's using open source software that a company might want to go after. But a less obvious example, I think, is given by the Microsoft. And Microsoft recently had an issue where they were sort of waving some flags relative to Android as well that just happened the other day. In terms of having a business model that they see threatened by open source and trying to create some either fear, uncertainty, or doubt, or sort of trying to protect that business model. Those are the two main scenarios that we see out there. And it does seem that the open source developers themselves are not being directly sued, although, of course, they would, if there is an infringement judgment, it's their product that would be adjudged to be infringed, right, even though they're not the direct defendants.
Yeah, we can get into the issues of warranties and all that later, but and leaving aside Microsoft, because nobody knows what they're thinking. I don't know. But we haven't seen a single case brought by a troll or a non-practicing entity, which I mean, it is surprising, but it also maybe goes right into what Julie was saying, that there isn't yet an economic, sufficient economic model for a troll to be shaking down companies and accusing open source software. Now, that day may come. A lot of people have said being a target of a software patent infringement suit just means you've grown up. You know, the open source community has grown up, and now it's being targeted just like anybody else's. So it's a badge of honor. I'm not sure I believe that. But yeah, so we haven't seen troll cases. We haven't seen cases against developers. And in terms of openness, I guess the one difference I see in software, in open source infringement cases that you don't see in proprietary cases, and I hope my friends from Sun will take this as a joke, which is what it is this urge to blog about it, which you don't have in a proprietary case. Nobody wants to say anything. But whenever you have an open source software litigation of any kind, everybody wants to, you know, wants to say something. As an outside counsel, it's just not a very happy moment for me.
Well, and we at Sun were on both sides of that issue. I mean, you know, in the SCO litigation with Novell, you know, there was a lot of sentiment against Sun because there was a perception amongst the Grok Law, you know, type community that we weren't intervening to sort of end that litigation when there was a speculation that we could. And then, you know, in terms of the Sun NetApp litigation, I think the open source community, the Grok Law community, quickly jumped in and organized prior art searching to help come to the defense of ZFS, the Zettabyte file system that Sun had open sourced that was, you know, that is currently still an accused product in the Sun, now Oracle, NetApp litigation. So it is
I think that's a really good point. I mean, because when we talk about, you know, follow the money, there are two sets of money to follow, right? One is the amount of money you could extract if you won your patent lawsuit, and then the amount of money which you're talking about in terms of litigation costs is how much it costs to defend. Well, you know, I mean, it depends on the value you get from this community, but if you have a group of folks searching for prior art for free, right, in terms of no cost to you, at least that is something that most proprietary companies don't. I mean, having worked on many patent litigations when I was in private practice, right, I mean, you think the lawyers are expensive, they are, but the experts and the researchers and the searchers for prior art, I mean, they can be very expensive too. So I do think that that's, you sort of have to look at both sides. And one of the things that's interesting is that open source models are about distributing both of those, right? Distributing both the benefits and the costs, right? So no one entity has all the value for any one software product in open source. And in some sense, you might also be able to distribute the costs. And so maybe that's been kind of why the mm-hmm. trolls can't figure out the right mm-hmm. model, right? If you go after Microsoft, in theory, all the costs and benefits are there. Right. So you can do the calculus a little easier.
Right. And you know, the patent damages present a huge challenge, right? I mean,
yeah,
you look at lost sales or reasonable royalty. Well,
software's free.
Yeah, you start going around. Yeah, exactly. And especially when you get into the concept of, okay, well, maybe you can demonstrate, you know, how many copies were downloaded from here, but, you know, one degree out, you can't. And then you don't know how that code was modified to possibly mm-hmm. be non-infringing. So it's very vexing for a judge, I think, you know, to confront a damages analysis that involves open source software if it's not linked to, you know, say the manufacturer of a product or something else that you can tie to a revenue stream. So I think they're very concerned about that. And I think that it's interesting that, you know, to ponder the question of, you know, if you are a company that you have you've got some closed software and you have concerns about potentially competitive, you know, a patent litigation from a competitor, you know, whether open sourcing that software might be, you know, to your advantage because you get the benefit of, you know, the community participating in, you know, your, you know, defense and prior art searching. Now, obviously, you wouldn't want to go out and open source your software in the face of a patent threat without getting, you know, a legal counsel and an opinion letter. But, you know, it's just, I think it's food for thought on that point.
Yeah, so it sounds like the open source development community, which is based upon crowdsourcing development of software, has also sort of had this informal crowdsourcing of patent defense of open source projects, which kind of has another gloss of maybe difficulty that's keeping away some of the patent trolls. Well, so it sounds like that the users of open source tool and software, not the developers, but the users, might face some patent risk. So at this point, I want to kind of turn to some of the strategies that have been developed by users of open source tools to kind of mitigate their risk of patent infringement. And I'm going to turn this over to Jason and Jennifer, who have been working on a very interesting, I think a novel defense strategy. Yeah, relatively novel. I don't know, novel by patent standards, but
I'm not going to go there.
I don't know if there's prior art there, but yep.
So, all right. So we put together some slides. Please forgive us, but it's a little bit. Hopefully, be a little easier to walk you through this idea that we have for a defensive patent license. There we go. So yeah, you might be wondering now. Well, is this a solution without a problem? Right. But how many people here know what defensive patenting is? Just dedicated. All right. So sort of that side of the room. Okay. So what I want to talk about is not necessarily how this is going to save open source, but in a way in which that defensive patenting could be beneficial to open source in general as a sort of building up of a sort of defensive genre of patents much broader than we have now. So what I'm going to talk about, four things as quickly as possible, probably less than 10 minutes, I hope. Which is, what is defensive patenting? Why do it? Why don't FOSS firms generally defensively patent? What is our defensive patent license? And how might it actually help solve any patent problems, if at all? So defensive patenting basically is this idea that you don't get patents to license them for money or to sue people and to exclude them, but you want to deter offensive lawsuits. So in theory, the only time you would ever use these patents is when you've been sued or one of your customers maybe has been sued or sort of, and you respond with your own patent lawsuit, and it creates this sort of detente-like effect, right? A mutually assured destruction-like effect. They sue you sue them, and then eventually you settle. And in patent-heavy industries with well-resourced competitors, it has often led to kind of broad cross-licensing. So like the semiconductor industry and a lot of the chip makers, you know, have thousands of patents, and eventually they all just kind of make this deal, okay, you get license all of ours, we get a license all of yours, we'll kind of work it out. But generally it also requires some level of overlapping technology. So that's the general theory behind defensive patent. So when thinking about defensive patenting, we thought about sort of, this is something that Jennifer and I have been working on actually for a couple of years and have sort of worked with this in terms of certain specific situations with clients and patents. There's sort of these three problems you could kind of run up against, that there are patent threats from competitors, patent threats from trolls, or patent threats from bullies, as we'll call them, and we'll describe that in a second. So the competitor threat is sort of the classic one, right? So you get these really expensive litigations between competitors. We've already heard that that's kind of one area where you may have seen this in open source. But they're very costly, and they're sort of costly on sort of three different levels that we've identified. One, there's just a lot of information costs, right? If you have people like IBM with thousands of patents, or Cisco, or you know various other companies, now Microsoft, it's very expensive to go through them all, figure out you know which claims they have, what they cover, how valuable they are, and you kind of there's a fear of willful infringement, so you don't really want to look too closely at them. And that really leaves you kind of without a lot of information, or that to get that information has a very high cost. There's also the high cost of losing. So if you lose a patent lawsuit and you're enjoying your whole product, it can be very expensive. So one example of that is NTP versus RIM, when they sued over to the BlackBerry. The jury, after the judge enhanced the damages, it was $53 million, but they ended up settling the case for $612.5 million in order to prevent an injunction shutting down the BlackBerry service. So clearly there's a high cost there, although after eBay versus Merck Exchange from the Supreme Court, it's not as much. But it's still significant. And then, as Julia mentioned, the high cost of litigation, right? Millions of dollars there. So if you can use defensive patenting to create these cross-license portfolios, you can, maybe it's not no information cost, but sort of low information cost, low threat of injunctive relief, low litigation cost. In fact, it could even be zero because you have a license, they have a license. You don't even have to know what the patents cover, right? You just know that they're not a problem anymore. Right? They can't sue you, they can't enjoin you, you don't have to spend money on litigation. So in theory, this creates more certainty, more predictability for innovation cycles, you can do some risk profiling, and you can kind of funnel more money into an R&D and, in theory, create greater consumer welfare. All right, well, what about patent trolls? Well, generally, this is where patent trolls have been successful, is that defensive patenting doesn't work against them because you can't countersue patent trolls if they don't make, use, sell, or offer for sale a product, right? So this has sort of been where defensive patenting has fallen flat on its face. There's no counterstrike against these people because they don't do any act that would trigger an infringement claim. However, as we're going to discuss with our DPL, we think that if you could get a patent to be truly defensive for its lifetime, like completely defensive, can't come back from that, then trolls at least won't acquire those patents and use them. And that's been one of the models that trolls have used. They've kind of gone through bankruptcy and other things to try and pick up patents. And if they couldn't get any value out of it, they wouldn't get it. So what about bullies? Well, so this is kind of the sort of Goliath versus David model. We're sort of just using that as a shorthand. But there have been some instances where we've seen big players try and come after new entrants into a market. And these are some examples, and it's really been kind of a bullying kind of tactic with patents. And here we think defensive patenting could help reduce threats, but for several reasons, which we'll talk about, that we think open source and free software projects also have, it's been sort of underutilized. So why doesn't FOSS use defensive patenting? So this is mostly anecdotal. We haven't done an empirical study like Pam. We'd love to. Perhaps we will. But I think it goes along with the empirical study that Pam worked on and some of the other theories we had from talking to people. One is that it's generally been a concentrated model, right? So you have these big companies, or at least companies of significant size and resource, and they concentrate all the costs and benefits, right? So they file for all the patents, they do all the searches, they sort of build these portfolios, and they have the money to fight back if they get sued, right? FOSS has generally lacked these resources, but as we can talk about, there's this open innovation network model where a number of companies have sort of donated their patents to that model, and we can talk about that. It's still sort of a concentrated model with this one entity controlling it. Second is, and I'm really glad that Stormy brought this up, is there's a huge cultural and political opposition to software patents, right? I mean, this sort of anti-freedom kind of thing. And we sort of break it down in two ways. One is just that patents, especially when you talk to software developers, they tend to get associated with bad actors, right? They're anti-competitive, they're bullying, they're patent trolls. It's just not something you want to be associated with. And then also there's this sense of inappropriate subject matter. Are you patenting math? These are laws of nature, algorithms. These are just not things that anyone should own, right? So there's sort of a cultural and political opposition there. And then finally, which also came up on the first panel, which I was happy to hear, is that there's a distrust of the defensive commitment, right? Will that change? Will they become offensive at some point? And will they stay defensive over their life? So there are these sort of three concerns. So what is a DPL? So we could go into more detail, but as a general matter, it's kind of structured similar to the GPL or other open licenses like Creative Commons in the sense that it's a distributed licensing structure, so anyone can kind of use it. And basically what it does is the licensor puts their entire patent portfolio under it, every single patent, right? This is something we can talk about whether it's a good or bad thing, but we felt like it was really clear you're making a commitment to defense. And what it says is you'll give an automatic non-exclusive royalty-free perpetual worldwide license to anyone who wants, and it's irrevocable unless the licensee sues another DPL user, someone who's taken or given a license, non-defensively, or they stop offering their own patents under this. And that licensees have to offer their whole portfolio as well. And so what happens is the incentives are, if you want all the patents, say, from an Oracle, and say they were to offer it under DPL, then you would also have to do the same, and then they could never revoke those patents unless you basically went on the offense or you dropped out of the pool. Right? So as long as you stay in the kind of pool network, and as long as you never offensively sue anyone, you get a free license to everything they have, and they also get a free license to everything you have. Network effects kind of come in. You can continue to litigate and license against anyone who is not part of this network, right? So you can go after and sue anyone you want for as much money or exclude them as you, if you want, if they're not part of this network, right? So it sort of creates an inside-outside kind of system. And then you can stop offering the DPL with appropriate notice. We haven't figured out the exact time. We think about maybe 6 months might be right. And then what happens there is anyone who's already previously taken a license gets to keep it. And your DPLs can be revoked because you've left. But in theory, you could leave, your DPLs could be revoked, and then any new patents you get in the future, you can do anything you want. But the thing is, anyone who got the licenses while they were there gets to keep them, and then they are, in theory, safe from your litigation. So why does this help? And then I'll end on just a couple of issues that have come up that people have expressed concern over. So we think it distributes some of the costs and benefits that have been concentrated so far with defensive patenting via these network effects. There are going to be companies like Sun, like Oracle, like Google, perhaps even, who have already invested in patents. Maybe startups are sometimes investing in patents. If they have, they can bear those costs. We can also possibly get pro bono help if we really have a truly defensive commitment from someone to kind of get more patents going. And all the users in the network benefit from this commitment to defense. Everyone gets the license and doesn't have to worry about those patents. It eliminates the information injunctive and litigation costs within the network, similar to the cross-licensing detente that happens with the big players. And it has the sort of low cross-licensing costs of the GPL and Creative Commons, and that you know what the license is. It's very upfront. Once you get used to it, you sort of learn the rules of the road, and then you can go forward. Also, it could actually use the high legal information transaction cost of patent strategy to encourage the growth of the network. In other words, if the network starts to grow and you have maybe 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 patents in it, the benefits of being in there and not having to worry about any of those patents could start to get really good if it would cost you a lot to figure out, hey, are any of these 5,000 patents a real problem? Right? So if you're a startup company and you're like, man, I don't even want to look at all these patents, they could be a big threat, I'd rather just become part of this network, that could actually get more people to join. More people join, network gets bigger, benefits to everyone. The other thing is that it does in some way support these cultural norms. It could come back to kind of mitigate against this sort of anti-patent thing that is existing in terms of cultural and political norms, in the sense that it's very explicitly to promote freedom to innovate, access to knowledge, and protection from legal constraint. These patents would be locked into this as long as you're in the network, and people can take the license and then they get it irrevocably. And it's not so long ago that, in fact, there was a lot of resistance to copyright covering software in decades past, and that we kind of got over that resistance and found out that we could use an instrumentalist approach with the GPL and Creative Commons, that we could actually say, okay, fine, if copyright is covering software, we may not have liked it, but now we have licenses to deal with it, and we feel like this could be a way to kind of move forward in that direction. And then finally, we think it is actually a legally binding commitment to defense. People can't change their mind once you take a license from them. They can leave, but if you took a license, you get to keep it. Although there are some issues around bankruptcy. So I'll end on that. These are some of the concerns that we've heard about this, and we're certainly thinking through how best to tweak this. If you have other concerns or ideas, we'd love to hear them. And that's our idea.
Great. So any reactions from the panel to this new strategy?
Do it.
Yeah. You're going to sign up all your clients.
Yeah.
You're going to get their entire patent portfolios now.
How about
I don't have any.
On the last panel, we talked about the split strategy, right? This would mean probably at the startup stage, you make a decision that your patents are going to be defended.
Just just predicting to what some of my clients would say is all of this is useful and a good first step, but a troll will find some patent that's not in this pool and they'll come after me, and then I have nothing.
Yeah, I guess that was my question, too. I mean, I see the ability to remove the potential use of the patent by the troll you know, if it's obviously part of the pool, what I don't see is kind of the threat for the, you know, the incentive for the troll not to find something else, mm-hmm. right, and sue you. And
yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things, though, is I don't know that this changes the troll problem at all.
Right.
In other words, I think the troll problem currently exists and will continue to exist the same with the minor change that maybe we take a few more patents out of the arsenal. But I don't think this is going to help that problem or hurt it.
The minor change that to the extent that the network grows and it's useful to be defensive, you might end up having a few more patents or going after a few more patents than you would have, which gives you maybe another target for a troll. But that seems pretty minor in the face of the issue created by, non-practicing entities.
Yeah, I think another comment, though, is that it certainly makes the market more liquid as well. Mm-hmm. Right, so I mean, if you have a large group that maybe could pool its resources in acquiring patents to pull into the pool, I mean, I guess the side effect of that is that you're going to raise the cost for the troll to acquire, you know, whatever it is that they might otherwise have used to come after you. Mm-hmm.
So, what are some other strategies that startups or small or even large companies that use open source software can mitigate their risk of patent infringement or have been threatened? What are some strategies that you have seen work or have tried?
I'd say first, you know, when I was starting to kind of noodle about this, you know, what is in particular different about open source patent litigation and what I counsel clients that are developing software, you know, part of the difficulty about software and software patents is they're really hard to interpret. Right, it's not like you're looking at a widget that has, it's tangible and in front of you. Instead, what you're usually given is a set of claims that are, you know, widely open to interpretation. You're usually given a specification that has a lot of things that are not so clear and, you know, it leaves a lot of ambiguity. And so, for clients that, you know, typically have devices, you know, we might recommend you do a freedom to operate sort of opinion or clearance. And it's a very difficult thing to do in the software space, and it can be very expensive, and for people who are particularly with respect to open source, you know, it's hard to pool that money together to do something like that. There are other things that you can typically do, and in some ways, they boil down to more contractual mechanisms, and I think Lucky might be able to. I was going to talk in a few of these, you know, indemnities, reps, and warranties. As a person negotiating on one side, I think you always have to ask, you know, who can stand up for the indemnity, who can stand up for the rep and warranty. At the end of the day, is it really going to permit somebody else to kind of step in my shoes if I use their open source product in the face of a multi-million dollar lawsuit? And you know, many times indemnity provisions work well in small kind of contractual settings, but when you start talking about the financial stakes involved in a patent litigation, that can be a difficult sort of thing. It could even drive a lot of people into bankruptcy.
Do you know how often that even gets used in the proprietary? I mean, I know that Microsoft stepped in for a Dell, Lucent Alcatel was, I think, it's something where they stepped in, but I don't know how often they even get invoked.
Yeah, well, I guess I don't know the data about how often they're invoked. I would say that they're awfully difficult to negotiate, and usually the issue is not just solvency of who's actually going to provide the indemnity, but how you actually define it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the problem with you know, maybe software patents in particular is that it's really a hard thing contractually to spell out what kind of use is going to trigger that indemnity clause. Versus what doesn't, you know, is it the intended use? Is it, you know, something that was foreseeable in addition to, you know, whatever is actually claimed there? And so, you know, you can imagine that you have a software claim, where you have a processor and memory, and maybe, you know, something's done on the processor, and then it gets displayed, and you know, the company providing the software does everything but display the, the allegedly infringing software, and so. Does the display, was that foreseeable? I mean, probably it was. But, you know, that sometimes gets left out of these clauses, or it's a very hard position to take.
The indemnities do get invoked. I've seen them between commercial entities, not in the open source world, but, you know, these are disclaimable
warranties. And I think, you know, everybody should be aware of that, that if you don't want to have a problem, just disclaim them. You know, people forget to do that. But even under the latest principles of software contracting that ALI came up with, you know, it's a clearly disclaimable warranty. And if you don't disclaim it, then by transferring software to somebody else, you're warranting that what you've transferred them is free of infringement.
I think the way the indemnities play out is really, from what I've seen, has been very interesting, which is it seems that a lot of companies are getting into the practice of, you know, new patent litigation comes in and they fire off the form letter to anyone and everyone they've ever contracted with to put them on notice that there's a potential indemnity claim, and that, you know, I don't think that those necessarily play out and rarely actually result in any kind of meaningful indemnity. Whereas the interesting flip side is, I think that you see companies who, you know, if they see their business model threatened, and they see a customer or a downstream user sued for patent infringement, they don't want that customer, you know, litigating the case. So they're going to step in, contract or no contract. So it's kind of counterintuitive. It seems like when the contracts are there, they rarely get invoked. But there's oftentimes, you know, people are disregarding the contracts and just moving into to protect, protect their revenue.
Well, so let me have one more question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. But I'm curious about creative defensive strategies, in particular things like peer-to-patent. So if one of the panelists can say a little bit about what peer-to-patent is and how that might be used defensively.
Yeah, I can describe it.
Sure.
So how many people here have ever seen peer-to-patent? Just two. Okay. So it's a website. It was started out of New York Law School to kind of create a crowdsourced Web 2.0 sort of way to look for prior art that could be relevant to a pending patent application, so that they would get a pending patent application that would get published while it was still pending at the patent office, and then sort of experts over across the web could have a conversation and could like upload or link to relevant prior art, and then that would all sort of get ranked, and then the best parts would kind of get sent to the patent office. And it was a partnership, actually, they were able to achieve with the patent office that I believe is going to continue and grow, in fact, where then the patent examiner who gets the file will get not only what the patent applicant gave them, but also this kind of crowdsourced expertise to whatever extent it would help them kind of start to get their his or her head around kind of, well, what are the scope of the claims and how, what was known before, and kind of make that job easier. And the incentive structure they came up with, which was sort of interesting, they came up with this notion that if you voluntarily put your patent application into this process, you'll kind of jump to the front of the line. So your patent application will get examined faster, and potentially you'll get your patent sooner if you're going through this more rigorous process. And so it's a kind of partnership between the patent office and this law school tech experiment. And so far, it seems to be going pretty well. I don't know if there's any objective evidence one way or the other, but it does, from what I hear and from what I've seen, some people have said that the art that was sent, the prior art that was sent to the patent office has been pretty useful.
So companies who see a threat on the horizon, potentially, for patent litigation or open source software, could be involved in submitting and finding prior art and contributing to these crowdsourced databases.
Yeah, there's some really interesting issues around identifying yourself on the site, right? Because there's this whole thing, like if I work for, you know, Sun, and I'm interested in this patent that, say, Microsoft has, do I want to identify myself and say, oh yeah, I know exactly what that is, right?
Right.
So there's some issues around that, too.
Right, in terms of willfulness. And
willfulness, and just, yeah, I mean, sort of raising your flag and saying, hey, I'm looking at your patent, and I'm really interested in it.
So the pitch is for people to participate in the peer-to-patent by, you know, making patents better. I mean, a lot of this criticism of software patents is you know, being evil and all that is probably directed at the fact that a lot of them are just crap. They're not describing anything that was new, and that's not what the patent system is meant to protect. Now, that's not exclusively a problem with software patents, but it is probably more so in the software patent world for a lot of reasons. Now, I would say, however, that in the few cases of patent infringement against open source software, we haven't seen the crappy patents asserted, at least not in my experience, having spent a lot of hours looking at the patent that was asserted against Red Hat. I mean, this was a pretty complicated patent that wasn't trivial to invalidate, although we eventually filed a re-exam and we believe that it was invalid, but it wasn't a patent on a method to add two single-digit numbers. I mean, it was a little more complicated than that.
Okay, so let's toss it out to the audience. We have any questions? Okay.
I would actually like to go right on what you just said about crappy patents actually being asserted. In my view, from a very community-oriented point of view, one of the scariest actions out there right now is Apple's suit against HTC, which is a very strong attack against Linux. And it involves a number of patents that read on very basic technologies that have been around since the mid-1980s, if not longer than that. Some of them are clearly very low-quality patents, but they're being used to this point. So I guess I'm curious what the panel thinks, first of all, about the Apple HTC suit and what we can do about that. And what do we do about this thicket of really low-level patents that do threaten a lot of the things that we're trying to do?
I think we could elaborate further on re-exam, because I think that is a really effective tool. It's been a really effective tool for us in patent litigation. I'd encourage everyone to check out the recent statistics, the most recent PTO statistics. I think, you have right now for ex parte re-exams at the PTO, you only have about 25% of the patents coming through with all claims affirmed. And then for inter partes, it's incredibly low. I think you only have about 6% of the patents coming through inter partes re-exam with all claims affirmed. So I think that right now is our best tool for getting at the crappy patents. It's more cost effective. You really need, and this is just off the top of my head, I would say between $25,000 and $40,000 for to initiate a re-exam on the average patent. And it's not quick, but it's certainly ex parte. I actually don't know the times right now on ex parte and inter partes. Inter partes is quite a bit longer. I think it's 36 to 40 months right now. Ex parte is much faster. But that's a really effective tool, and one that I think a lot of the things we've been talking about, at least from my perspective, really involve larger companies or mid-sized companies and the tools that they can use. When you're talking truly about the community, I think that would be one tool that could be accessible just based on the cost. Also, like the Red Hat example that Lucky mentioned, I think the community may be able to go and approach companies that that also may have a stake in the fight because they have their own products that may be implicated by those patents, and encourage those companies to trigger re-exams where they think they would be effective and where they think those interests are aligned. So those are...
Just to clarify, for those who don't know, the re-exam is basically a procedure where you return to the patent office and say, hey, you improperly granted this patent. We believe it's invalid. Take another look. And that can be used to get rid of some of these clearly obvious software patents.
Well, You're asking that they re-examine the patentability of it under certain kinds of prior art standards, and actually one of the downsides is that you can't really point to products that existed. It really has to be a patent or publication. But I will say that when I worked at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and ran the patent busting project there, we filed 7 re-exams, all 7 were granted, and claims were either canceled or narrowed substantially. So I do think it's effective. But this question of crappy patents, right, it's also a question of how many of them are there, and there are lots of them, right? So there's sort of, you could sort of try at the front end to limit what the patent office grants, and that's kind of where peer-to-patent kind of comes in. You can kind of wait and see kind of which ones are getting asserted, and then you can kind of do re-exam. The other thing, though, is that it's just, I think, while the benefits are really high for people to file, and those benefits can be some of the things we talked about the perception, at least, that you'll get funding, other things, it's a lot of incentives to keep filing on everything or almost everything within certain companies, and I think that's just really hard to fight against.
I would add just one thing as well. All of us can disagree about what makes for a good and bad, or if there is a good software patent. But, you know, bad claims exist, and it, those are the easier ones that usually are knocked out during invalidity searches and you know, re-exam. It's claims that, you know, that you see commonly in litigation that, that may span, you know, a couple columns within a patent that are narrowly tailored to some sort of product or some sort of service. And, you know, it would be interesting. I don't know, maybe there's a way of doing some sort of kind of pooled license or kind of negotiating that in the open source community. Because, you know, if we kind of go with the assumption that there are software patents and that they're per se not invalid, I guess that's going to, you know, maybe be answered, maybe not, by the Supreme Court
but
soon.
Not yet today.
Not today. So,
check your blog.
You know, assuming that there are software patents and that not all of them are bad software patents and that some of them are, you know, not totally, you know, easy to knock out, then maybe there's some sort of other mechanism that could be crowdsourced or open sourced in a way that kind of pools together and kind of affirmatively treats the open source community maybe like what, you know, a bricks and mortar company might have to do in that same sort of position, you know, negotiate a license or some sort of contractual relationship.
And that's part of you know what we were trying to think about with the DPL. It's not, you know, quite like the Open Innovation Network, obviously, because it isn't centralized and instead it's decentralized and transparent. And the idea is that smaller companies, you know, that may have some software patents or are worried about software patents could all commit to this defensive license and get the cross license from everybody else who also commits to it. So it takes time, it takes a network, it takes people deciding to make that commitment and join the network. But to the extent that you have, as Jason was saying, you know, 5,000 patents in the network or some reasonable number of patents in the network, then maybe that can begin to alleviate some of these concerns a little bit.
Okay, we'll take another question from the audience over here.
I'm defending two small software companies from patent infringement. And I'd like to ask the two big boys from the big firms, how often do you, with the wildly interpretive claim interpretation of software patents, how often do you see a Rule 285 attorney fee granted, you know, against the bully or the troll? Is it almost never, or do you know?
Never in my practice.
Yeah. I've never had that experience either, but I don't know exactly how often that would be.
The standard is under extreme or exceptional circumstances.
Exceptional, whatever that means.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's very, very difficult.
I call red, orange, you know, is that exceptional? You know, that type of thing.
So I'd say the difficulty in that, at least with software patents, is that, you know, you're given a lot of benefits of the doubt, right? In that, you know, there is always some sort of interpretation. Obviously, in every patent litigation, you get to a stage of interpretation that we call a Markman hearing, where you try to figure out what the claim terms actually mean. And even if it seems straightforward, sometimes you end up with definitions for those terms that you wouldn't really read into them at first glance. And, you know, in different courts, you know, if it were a perfect world and we kind of, you know, run two patent litigations of the same patent side by side, I bet you we'd probably get different Markman hearings or Markman, you know, mm-hmm. conclusions on these terms. And so I think it's a difficult process. My experience, no, I've never seen it.
There was this is not in software context, but it just happened this week, so I'll mention it. But there was a fee award in a medical device case, in the Medtronic case in district court in Denver a few years ago, $4.3 million fee award against counsel and the party, and that was just overturned on appeal. So even when the judges order it, it was that order was vacated.
So I realized I inadvertently omitted the rule where the students have to ask a question. So if there are any students, I only see one in the room that I recognize. Yeah, he's off the hook. Any other students? Okay. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, building right here.
On the defensive patent license, I'm wondering about transferability. You talked a little bit about bankruptcy, but what about assignment and, you know, all the other things?
Assignment of the patent or the license?
What would happen? I mean, what we've been talking about in the earlier panel is, you know, a small company
gets acquired.
Getting acquired, because that's their exit strategy, right?
Yeah. So the way we've drafted the license is that it's irrevocable unless you stop being defensive, in very, very simplistic terms. And we're pretty comfortable that that will travel through something like acquisition. What we're not sure about is bankruptcy. And we care about bankruptcy in part because that's where trolls get patents. That's one place that trolls get patents. But we feel pretty comfortable that we are able to craft it in such a way that it travels through entities moving around like that.
Let me just say...
Can I ask you a question? Because I'm interested. Do you think that smaller companies might be concerned? I think this is Sir Brian's question. Would they be concerned about entering into it as it being sort of a time bomb when they're going out and they're in acquisition due diligence?
Right. And that's partly a question, too, for Jason Mendelsohn from the last panel, right? Like, what does your VC say when you come to them and you say, guess what, I want to be defensive and I actually want to commit to that in a pretty strong way?
Yep. Or your acquirer, you know, let's say you're not going out to for venture capital, but you're trying to be acquired and they're doing diligence and they don't want this to extend to their portfolio.
Yeah, with the exit strategy.
It can be, so be a big concern.
There is this question, though, I mean, in terms of how you structure the acquisition, too, about whether the greater entity would have to suddenly join or not. But in terms of the smaller entity, I mean, this is one of those things that had to be sold with open source, I think, is you had to be really clear about what it is and what it isn't. And what we're saying here is that you're making, there's a lot of rhetoric around defensiveness, and this is actually making you walk the walk, right? So what you're saying is, look, we've just committed to not suing offensively anyone else who's made the same commitment. We can sue offensively anyone who hasn't made the commitment, and we can always sue defensively, and that's our business model, right? And we're sticking to it, and we've actually legally bound ourselves. We still think we're a valuable company. We do great things. This is just how we're planning to go. And if you can make that case, and I think you have to believe it, then we're saying then you can walk the walk. If you say you're defensive but you don't commit to the license, it opens up a conversation about are you actually really committed to it or not.
And I will say that, you know, way back when I was in private practice, there were similar questions around open source, and particularly the GPL. Mm-hmm. You know, we heard in the last panel that maybe the GPL version 3 has given cover to version 2. But some of that discomfort has started to diminish over time. The other thing, just as nuts and bolts practical matter, is that we have crafted it so that you can stop using the DPL with 6 months' notice. You can't stop as to the people you've already granted licenses for the technology that was already under the license, but you can stop going forward. So just as sort of a nuts and bolts practical matter, if you're thinking 2 years down the road, you realize that you could, with 6 months' notice, get out of it at least for future technologies or future patents. So there's that kind of leeway in there. But absolutely what Jason said, like, yes, we're saying you're making this decision and that you will be defensive.
So you lump copyright in there too, or just patents?
This is just patent. This is just for patents.
See, that could be a problem.
Do you want to say more? Because I think the current open source licenses.
Let's say I just picked, I can talk about it. I was a copycat for years. So kids who are 10, boys. So, if you look, let's say I've got a small company and I'm in a hurry to create the product, and I've got a couple of patent applications, and I buzz through because I take the fast track, and I get the community that you mentioned through at New York University at Tamalas. Okay, so I get in there, but I only have a couple, but I do have some technology I expect to protect with copyrights. So you have to lump that in, because that could be, just because something's patentable doesn't necessarily include what I have that I consider as copyright.
Sure, but I think then the sort of set of open source license, free and open source licenses handle copyright, so you'd have to make that decision there, but we felt like that's a problem that has been addressed.
But you'd have to be both there.
But wanted to present yourself, as truly open, then you would choose one of the existing free open source software licenses for your copyrights, and then you would choose the DPL for your patents.
And then you sell, because it is an issue, a brand name. Service model or trademark. So now you have somebody out there who's maybe they're not so, I mean, the name Google or, you know, throw out some of the very famous ones, and they get in a tip, but it's brand name, so it's a totally a service mark or a trademark tip, and now they're stuck in here in the patent license pool. Committees do not go after one another, but their management can't stand sitting in the same room because of the passing off for trademarks. So have you looked at maybe branding?
I think that's a great question, but we're running into our very rare and precious break for Silicon Valley. So let's take that offline if you want to come down. Our panelists will still. But let's thank our panelists for a wonderful and very interesting panel.
It's so great to hear so many talented speakers.